Hello, this is Richard Outram, and welcome to the Prepare for Growth podcast series, bite-sized wisdom for leadership and personal development. So thank you for taking time out to join me. I'm so grateful for this unique opportunity.
Okay, and in this week's podcast, I'm thrilled to introduce Grace Ong, founder and CEO of Savvy Growth and Savvy Marketing Group, which helps leaders and their companies maximize success through a unique combination of strategic marketing and management consulting, personal brand and leadership coaching. Dubbed Chinese Oprah, Grace is hired to give motivational keynotes on happiness and mental awareness. She also leads workshops on happiness, personal branding, and speaking success. Prior to Savvy Growth, Grace held a number of senior positions in marketing, product, and brand management for companies including Siebel, Clorox, and General Mills. Grace is an MBA graduate of the Harvard Business School and MIT Sloan Business School. She was also adjunct professor at MIT and UNC Flagler Keenan Business School in entrepreneurial marketing. She also holds a certificate in positive psychology from UNC Chapel Trail. And Grace's wisdom bite for this episode is, success does not create happiness. Happiness creates success. Grace, I am so thrilled to have you on the show. We have known each other for a couple of years now. We've been trading emails. We've had a few conversations. I think this is just such a wonderful topic. And most importantly, you've recently been so vulnerable in LinkedIn writings and LinkedIn posts and just general posts that you've made out there on such a journey for your own happiness, okay? And for that, you've been so inspirational to me personally, and I'm sure to many, many of the audience and your readers as well. So thank you for being on the show, Grace.
Oh, thank you so much, Richard, for asking me. I'm so happy to be here and to be able to share with the listeners.
Before I get started, Grace, was there anything else you wanted to add to the introduction that I may have missed?
Oh, no, I think we're good. Thank you.
All right, so let's get into it, Grace. So what have you learned? Let's talk about how you define happiness, Grace.
Yeah, happiness is something that you think that everyone knows what it is. So it's not necessarily the little smiley faces that you see, the emoticon, but that could be when you're happy, you could be exuding emoticons. So I think of happiness as when I feel joy, I have peace, and I'm grateful. I feel grateful about the things in my life.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's when I'm happy.
And how does meaning and perhaps optimism roll into a definition of happiness, do you think?
Yeah, quite a bit, because back to the gratefulness, I think that's all kind of intercorrelated. The meaning, like knowing what your meaning is and the impact that you have in your life, that's certainly helping others.
Yeah,
has shown that helping others is a key component of being happy.
Yes.
Absolutely. So having impact to others, that makes you happy. It's a virtuous cycle.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And why study happiness?
Yeah, so for me personally, I started my first year-long happiness journey 7 years ago when my son was leaving to go to college and I was going to become an empty nester. And as a single parent, he was a huge, huge part of my life. And I have a genetic predisposition due to my mom toward depression. My mom had suffered a lot from anxiety and depression in her life. And genetics, becoming depressed, 50% is based on genes. Yep. So I proactively went on a year-long positive psychology studies, a journey at that stage, and studying it proactively and then knowing exercises and knowing what makes you flourish and happy, I think that helps you in being happy. It's just like when people say you really know material when you have to teach it, it's because you have to really learn it in order to explain to someone else. And therefore, since I speak on it, give workshops on happiness and write about it, then it forces me to understand it. And then sharing it with others to help others, then as I was saying earlier, helping others makes you happy, because seeing someone else be helped, it's this virtuous cycle. So that's why I study. And that's, I would encourage others to in order to be happier, to study happiness.
And there's so much out there, Grace. I mean, you could just go along the book aisle of Barnes & Noble or just look it up on Amazon. And there's so much written about happiness. And it's exploded, particularly. And I know the positive psychology has been a big contributor of that. Why do you think, at least in the past decade or two, the topic of happiness has exploded?
Well, it's actually the terminology. When we were in college, positive psychology did not exist.
Yeah.
Marty Seligman is the father of positive psychology, because when he took over as being president of American Psychological Association, which was just about the time, it was over two decades ago, because it didn't exist three plus decades ago, that's when he gave birth to it. So he did research that showed that the ratio of studies, research papers written about human maladies compared to human flourishing was a ratio of 20 to 1.
Wow.
And at the same time, in the last couple of decades, the age of the onset of depression has decreased from about 30 to 14.5. So it's about the time someone enters high school. And so he thought that this ratio needed to be flipped. And that's when he started talking about and gave birth to this new field called positive psychology. And he matched a lot of research against and data against the studies. So that's why you've seen so much being written about happiness, because positive psychology started only in the last couple of last few decades. So that's why, so it's been scientifically studied.
Right, and it became the most famed happiness course in Harvard history.
Yeah. So Talpin Shahar, who I say is my main teacher, I recently told him that, that I speak about him every time I give a talk about happiness. He was the creator of Harvard. This is an undergraduate's most popular course ever, and it was on happiness. And people then, when they did research on when he first taught it, why the students took it, and a third of them said that they were in a depressed state, so that's why they took the class. And there was research done in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed that 47% of students at Harvard in the prior year had experienced such a case of depression that it stopped them from being able to function like normally in their life. And then when they looked at 13,500 students across the nation, and a lot of different types of schools, they found out the percentage was 45%. So it was very high. It's consistently about half of all youth in college have experienced severe depression, which is pretty scary.
That is profound. That's a profound stat. We're going to be talking more about, some of the symptoms and the reasons why, Grace. But is it about being happy in your life or happy about your life? Is this about experience versus remembered? I mean, there's a conversation piece around that's quite common, but I'd love to hear your point of view on that.
So I think that they're intertwined. So I think being happy, like in the moment now, by reflecting back on your life and realizing how grateful you are about things, that can make you happy now. So I think they're interrelated. When I talk in generalities about happiness, I'm thinking right now. I'm thinking about experiencing it. And definitely, it was very, very impactful to me when I saw that we spend the vast, vast majority of our time thinking about the future or thinking about the past, and sometimes ruminating, sometimes obsessing.
Yes.
And we don't spend enough time in the present. And one thing that I have found since going through and being in a very, very dark place last year and then coming out of that is that I'm able now to be more focused in being happy in the moment and not spending time thinking about the past or in the future, and just people say it a lot, but it really is hard to just focus on the now. And when I realized that the vast, vast majority of the time we don't, it was pretty scary. And then I realized that's why meditating can be very difficult for people. But truly being able to do that, and research shows that adding that to your life definitely increases your happiness.
That's one of my favorite topics, Grace. And you've gone to the place where I was going to go as well. Because the question here is happiness an inborn trait, yeah, or can you train your brain to be happier? And yeah, I'd like you to bring some of the notes around meditation into that, because I'm a firm believer in that. And I think you are as well.
Right,
you can
be
10% happier, and the stats, you know, definitely kind of put it out there. But I am a personal practitioner of meditation. And I just see how wonderful it is and life-changing it is. But I'd love to hear your opinion on that, please, Grace.
Yeah. So definitely genetics do impact quite a bit, like a 50%. And that's why I have been, I proactively started doing this because I knew that I have this genetic predisposition. And then another 25% is based on your circumstances. Another 25% is on habits that you develop. And so you, to answer your question, I think you can influence your happiness level by how you choose to live each day. And so putting things in place while you're doing well, keep on doing that, can help you. And that's what I am very conscious of doing, self-care things, putting it proactively in place as just part of your life, as preventative maintenance, because wellness is so important, being well and staying well versus waiting until you get sick and how to fix that, which I think is incredibly important to answer your question, to proactively do things to keep you happy.
Right. And you know, meditation is one practice, but you had touched on a very important point as well, of being mindful of the moment and living in the present. And I think that's a key thing, key trait, that we can all learn, particularly in this overstimulated world, Grace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Just being focused on what you're doing at the moment, at the very present. Yep.
We tend to worry about things in the future that most often than not don't even come to fruition.
Right.
There's nothing we can do about the past.
Right.
And yet that's just the human psyche and just human behavior. We tend to operate in those two zones rather than, as you say, right, what's happening right now, you know, and in the present moment.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So what are some of the key habits for happy people?
I think that being curious about things, other people, and also being courageous. I think that they're two different things, but those help you to be happy. I think that relationships, developing close relationships, deepening relationships. And I think being curious has to do a little bit with that, because if you're curious about other people and ask them questions and show interest in them, that can make you happy. But certainly celebrating with friends, being with friends and deepening friendships can bring happiness to you. And then the courageous part is, so often people don't try things because they think they either have to be perfect or they're afraid of failure. And that stops people from doing things. And so I think being courageous and doing things that you're afraid of and understanding what you're fearful of, it's really important. And in my year-long study of happiness and positive psychology, I developed these 7 themes that I call Project Peak, climbing the bounds of life, business, and beyond. And those 7 themes are such common sense themes, but as I learned from Tal Ben-Shahar, common sense is not that common. And so in those 7 themes, I include things about fear, about how failure is a good thing, how to channel fear to your advantage. So some really, really basic common sense things, but things that I thought would be worthwhile pointing out. And I also did this TED talk around that time, when I talked about climbing mountains, like the 7 summits, and put that the 10 steps to reach the top, both in figuratively in a business but then also talked about literally like when you're actually climbing one of the seven summits, things that you have to do in both endeavors, like choosing teammates, choosing your end goal, choosing your resources. Yeah. So you get to the top, and then, you know, deciding what constitutes success. Is it reaching the top, or is it the journey? And then enjoying the journey. So I end my seventh scene is enjoying the journey. And that's part of that mindfulness, like enjoying the moment versus worrying about the exit or thinking back at the past.
And so go a bit further on that one, Grace, because our key wisdom bite is success does not create happiness. Happiness creates success. And that's part of, yeah, it is an ongoing journey, not an end point. So just talk a little bit more about that. Let's emphasize the wisdom bite here.
Right. So in my studies, one of the Tao's teaching fellow, Sean Acor, he wrote a book called The Happiness Advantage. And in kind of his headline there is that so many people think, and I know I did, I thought just when I achieve this, just when I achieve that, then I'll finally be happy. But it's not that way at all. It's when you're happy, then naturally you'll be successful. And actually what data shows is that people who win the lottery, people who they do come about money, it doesn't bring lasting happiness. In fact, actually, if you study people who win the lottery, a lot of them fall into depression and many have committed suicide. So, if you study the happiness levels of those in the Forbes top 50 wealthiest people in the world versus the upper middle class American, there's not a demonstrably difference in happiness level. The difference is when you take someone who doesn't have enough to eat and take them to a level where they're good. That's when there's really a difference in happiness. Yeah. So it's really interesting that research shows that. And one interesting piece of research was those people who gained tenure, because tenure is something that professors work so hard at getting. And it's the same thing there. They have a temporary boost in their happiness level, but then they go back to their baseline of what they had before tenure. Yeah. So I think that there's a lot of research that's pretty compelling that made me appreciate that reaching all these different milestones that you think, well, oh, then I'll be really happy. It's the other way around. And when you stop and think about it, it really makes sense. But so many of us live the opposite, especially earlier in our life. We haven't quite figured it out. But older people, they think that too. So you have to kind of catch yourself.
Now, you mentioned about, fear being one of the kind of antidotes to happiness. Is that not just the human condition, Grace, that, you know, we're built that way?
Yeah, we are. We are wired that way. Yes. Yeah. So we're wired for good reasons.
Yeah.
So for our own safety, right? Because cavemen, they were, when there was no, it was just to stay alive. So certainly we are wired that way. And what I like to think about, a long, long time ago, one of my mentors, the professor at UNC who invited me to go and teach there, he asked me if I had a long held fear. And I really respected this mentor. So I thought about it. I said, well, it may sound kind of silly, but I always, as a child, was fearful of diving into a pool head first. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to address his question. And so I hired this Ironman athlete who I was training with at the time. And she took me to this very large aquatic center and she taught me the proper technique. And when she taught me, I immediately did it and I dove into the deep end, so it was safe. And I realized this is so easy, it's so elegant. And then I realized, okay, he probably asked me that question for a good reason. And then I thought, I literally learned how to dive into a pool head first safely. And then I thought that could be a metaphor for my life, that I could just go dive into something that I'm scared of. Because, you know, people always often say, oh, they dove right in. They use it metaphorically. So I think, like, when I coach people, a lot of times people talk about things that they're fearful of doing at work. And if you ask, what's the worst thing that could happen to you? And you realize that the worst thing that could happen to you isn't that bad. Right. And then you think about the best thing that could happen to you, and it's really quite good. Then you think, well, I should just dive in and do it. So that's one thing that happened to me that I actually went and addressed. It may sound really silly, but it was something that for years and years I was scared of. I was just really scared of doing a belly flop. That's what I was scared of, because that was the worst thing that could happen, right? And I was scared I was going to look like a fool in front of my friends, or it would hurt. I'm probably scared of both, right?
No, that's awesome. No, that's great. Great answer. And you emphasized, some of the key habits of happy people are relationships and community. And I remember the Blue Zone studies, if you remember those as well.
Yeah, Dan Buettner. I actually worked with Dan Buettner. He wrote the Blue Zones. I don't know. He wrote a book called Blue Zones about Blue Zones. Yeah.
And the key commonality with all those zones was the spirit of relationship and community and family and fun with friends and so on. So I guess where I'm going with this, Grace, is, you know, more and more you see our world is becoming more kind of isolated, either through technology or communities and how they're organized and arranged, societies and, subcultures getting more kind of isolated. That's just how we're living now.
Yes.
How do we tend to formulate stronger relationships and so on?
Right. So when we think about young people and the scary rates of depression and suicide, especially like on college campuses, you think about the use of technology, young people saying that they don't even know how to go up to someone and talk.
Right.
Because they don't do that anymore. Like, because they text, they use electronic gadgets. They don't know actually how to have a conversation. So it's really scary how technology, even though of course technology has so many wonderful applications, definitely, but it also has some things that have hurt as far as mental health, especially with younger people, because they haven't developed the skills. And then another thing that's been happening amongst young people is that adolescence is now so much, people go into maturity physically so much earlier in life, that there's such a gap between your mental, like your brain formation and your physical formation. So when you're like at 11 or 12, like becoming a woman or becoming a man, but your brain still is like many, many years away, it becomes a very scary time in your life where you can really, there's gonna be some mental wellness challenges. Then on top of that, you have all these electronic devices where people look perfect and happy all the time. It's not real, but you don't realize it's not real. And then of course, COVID overlaid on top of that, just that gives it, accelerates all those issues. So I think that thinking about why with young people, there's some problems. I think some of those are the reasons why. So I think just thinking about doing things like families doing things and friends doing things this old fashioned ways, like you used to would just go down the street and knock on your friend's door and go play somewhere in the neighborhood, but now everything's planned. You don't go knock on someone's door. So a lot of things that are old fashioned fun and play, people don't do anymore because you play on the internet as a multiplayer game. So things aren't real, things are electronic. And so sometimes I think that the best way to become happier is just to go back in time and do some old fashioned fun things where you just like talk in person. And of course COVID hurt that, and just doing old fashioned things that people don't necessarily do anymore.
I'm totally with you on that one. I know we sound like older folks on this one, but I'm totally with you. There were so much different values. If you kind of go back in time and, as you say, the social structures and getting together with friends and playing outside and not having to be isolated was key. And I mean, I can honestly say now I'm looking back to our thing, but our childhoods were just magnificent for that reason. Just great years of our lives,
Yeah. With no internet. Yeah. How could have lived?
No internet, no phones or anything, All right. So what are the challenges in finding happiness, Grace?
Oh, yeah. It's so elusive for so many people. So it seems like, and actually data shows this, that the higher people rise, the harder it is sometimes. And then also the harder you fall. So there's this thing called the striver's curse that Arthur Brooks talks about in his book, From Strength to Strength.
Yeah.
And people who really strive, they want more and more, and they're very, very, very smart people. It often is harder for them to be happy because they're always wanting more. They're never successful. And sort of this hedonic treadmill that he talks about, that you're always, always trying for the next thing. So you're never satisfied. And it's actually the opposite, because the Dalai Lama was one of Arthur's biggest mentors. And he talks about how it's when you're really happy with what you have,
Right.
And so you don't want more.
Yes.
Yeah. So satisfaction is when that want on the denominator is smaller of what you want and what you have on the top. Your satisfaction is correlated to that, because the more you want, the bigger it is on the denominator, then you'll just be more and more unhappy. So it's just being happy with what you have. Yeah.
Exactly.
You have.
You know, Grace, my wife and I, we were just streaming yesterday, and we came across the Netflix. There was a Netflix program of Oprah and Viola Davis. And I tell you, it was just absolutely superb. Talk about authenticity and vulnerability. It would make you cry. The way she spoke about, you know, just rising to the level of fame and success she had, and yet completely being unhappy. And she was talking about her, you know, her journey towards joy and happiness. But it came back to, no matter what success and fame she had gotten, she still was this little girl who came from poverty, extreme poverty, not even poverty I can even imagine. And that she had to work on her inner child and her inner self. And it was just a fascinating interview. It was beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. One entrepreneur that I was walking with the other day, who's gotten a lot of fame, she said that she actually thinks she was happier before, because when she said that all these accolades made life more complicated, actually didn't make her happier. So life was less complicated and easier. So it was just really interesting. It's kind of like akin to what you're saying, that some people, like wise people, they say, you know, I don't seek fame because it makes life all more complicated. So it's really how you use it. If you use it in a way to help others, that could be really glorious. So it's being aware of a lot of things, being self-aware, understanding yourself, and having a good relationship with yourself and taking care of yourself, loving yourself first. Yeah, that's important.
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. The happiness starts with yourself first.
Yes,
it really does. You cannot rely on other folks to kind of impart happiness on you. And I've learned that over the years.
Yep, that's so true. That's so true.
So true. So the challenges in finding happiness, valuing the wrong things. But what about, you touched on a point earlier about, what about not seeking social support?
Oh, not seeking social support. Yeah. So definitely not reaching out. Because someone said to me, like when I was talking about how I got better, they said, you were always seeking. You were always, and so it's so important not to like isolate yourself. Because when you're a dark hole, you have to fight that depression.
Yes.
Your natural inclination is, I want to sleep. I don't want to see anybody. I don't want to talk about this. You know, I just want to like curl up. And, you know, oftentimes people want to not be alive anymore. So being in that dark place, what you really have to do is the opposite. You have to fight it. You need to go out toward people. One time when I was giving a happiness talk to a group, oftentimes in my workshops, what I'll do is throw out one or two of my Project Peak themes. And then I ask people to come, if it's physically in the same place, come up to the mic and speak. And of course, with COVID, I do a lot of Zoom, WebEx types workshops where we do it virtually. In one of my in-person ones, this person who was a technical person, very introverted, he went up and said that he now goes to people, and it has made all the difference. Because he used to code in a dark room.
Yeah.
So going toward the light,
yes,
basically literally, in his case, because he was coding in the dark, has made all the difference in his happiness. So sometimes you have to fight your thing. And also some leaders that I work with, they're naturally introverted, but they know in order to be a good leader, because they have all these people who are counting on them, they have to be extroverted, because they have to go and be the company spokesperson, for instance. They have to go, so they're public, they have to go and speak to the analyst. So they have to fight like the introverted side of them. They have to go toward people. So sometimes in a work situation, leaders have to in order to be the leader for their people.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, well said there. And, you know, I wanted to quote a saying from a recent Harvard Business Review article, which is, you know, happiness should not be your goal, nor an end state, but a way of being. And for me, the key word is being, because, you know, we do, we feel, we do all this stuff, but a way of being, right? Which is so fundamental to being ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great quote.
It's a fabulous quote, isn't it? Because that's a very, very deep, that's a very, very deep meaning, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Yep. I think your meditation is working. Yeah.
I'm trying. I'm not an expert in any sense of the in any way, but I'm trying, and it has been really life changing. You see things completely different. It's been fabulous. All right. So, Grace, why is happiness the key to successful leadership?
Why is
happiness the key to successful leadership?
So, because when you're happy, that's when you can be successful. That's when you're flourishing the way you are, the energy you bring to the situation. So then you just naturally become you're a more inspiring person. You're a better leader. It just comes more naturally. People who are unhappy, it's really hard to be a good leader. People can see through that. So people who are happy, that's when people want to go towards you. And then that's when you make the better decisions, because you're flourishing, you have strong mental well-being, and therefore you can pass that energy and sharp thinking along in making your decisions and leading and inspiring people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said. Okay. You know, Grace, one of the things, and I'll go back to the Blue Zone example, and I forgot to mention it. It's, you know, and even in leadership, I found, and this has been a personal trait of mine, it's how about a sense of humor?
Yeah. It definitely helps. So I took many years ago, I decided to take improv, because when I was asked to teach at UNC, that was a long time ago, that was 15 years ago, my mentor, he told me that the thing he did in order to get ready as a teacher, he was already an entrepreneur, he was retiring into being a professor, is he went and took improv. So he said that improv, being in the moment and doing the yes and things just, when you do improv, it's just funny because you don't even mean to be. But he said that doing that was the best preparation to being a professor. And now business schools, they have improv as part of their curriculum. And then I've used improv when I've facilitated sessions for leadership teams that we're not getting along, because yes and is important, because it then you're asking people to collaborate versus being against them. It's not yes but. And so I think that bringing improvisation, which can become humorous, and humor, well, it lightens the situation. It definitely brings people together. That's why people want to go and see comedians, right? So I think one thing that I teach this workshop called Speaking Success, and I talk about humor in the importance of humor, and I am not good at that at all. And one Asian affinity group that I spoke to, Asians, just as a stereotype, I can say this about myself since I'm Asian, oftentimes Asians, like people who come here from the first generation, they're so serious. Yep. We don't realize that being humorous can be a good thing. So I was encouraging this affinity group in their many TED Talks that I signed them to do by the end of our 12 weeks together to add humor. I was very pleased with my students. They were adding humor in their talks because it may not have come naturally. So I said, that's one of the things that we have as a report card and a framework that I gave them. I said, please add humor. So I think it's so important for me. It doesn't come naturally. Like my son, he's a performer. He's in a band. We watched him perform this weekend for Earth Day. He just goes up there. He just naturally says funny things. So I always say, I want to grow up to be like my son. He knows how to have fun. Like I've only learned how to have fun more recently. And so he's always known how to have fun. He's just naturally up there on stage with a mic and just starts spewing out jokes. Just whatever he says, like, is funny. So he's just a natural. So I have a lot to learn from my son.
It's a beautiful thing, Grace. And I can tell you, there's nothing like a good laugh, crying with laughter, finding something funny in every situation. I've always believed in leadership that can absolutely, to your point earlier, can absolutely diffuse crisis situation. Unless someone's about to die, I always find that humor is just a wonderful way to relate to, you know, lessen blood pressure, people to see some level of clarity, et cetera. But I do believe also, Grace, that I think as a society, we're losing our sense of humor. I think there's been polarization. And I think back to your point about, you know, potentially fear and anger and aversion, some of that polarity and sticking to my point of view and only my point of view and not being able to laugh at ourselves is, it's been on the rise. I was really saddened years ago when Jerry Seinfeld said he doesn't even go in to do comedy skits now at colleges because the kids can't laugh at themselves or they find offense or some point of view. So,
oh, wow. That's really sad. Yeah, I think, of course, there's way too much anger, electronic anger. And definitely, I think it's interesting. Sometimes being funny, like, it doesn't come naturally to a lot of people. And I see some people are fearful of it. I'm a member of this group called IWF, International Women's Forum. And I thought, okay, I'm going to get more involved. I'm going to sponsor an event this year. And so I'm hosting an improv workshop. And when I first brought up that idea with some of the women, they were scared. They were like, I'm not going to go. They're just scared of like going up because they think they have to go up and perform. And then, I explained to them like the things that I was saying, and then they realized, they kind of said, okay, because they have their guard up about going up on, they think they're going to be up on stage, like having to say jokes or something. But so I don't think being funny comes naturally to a lot of people because people are too serious and maybe they're scared. And so I think people who can do it, like one of my classmates, he was a few years behind me in college. He studied electrical engineering at MIT, but he's a professional comedian in the Bay Area. And when I took my son to see the Bay Area for the first time, I called him up and said, I want to take my son to see you because I think I want him to learn from you. Yeah. And so my son's just naturally funny on stage. And this fella, Jeff Applebaum, he's such a cool guy. He's just natural. Well, actually, it takes a lot of work to come up with his lines, he tells me. But it's just, I think he's so talented. And I just always thank him for teaching me a little bit about humor in improv. Yeah, as part of my happiness journey. So I've actually written a blog post. I have him pictured in it, like, why study improv? I've written about that.
That is awesome. Okay, so what aspects, because you've talked about this and you've written about this, what aspects of business environments enabled you to be happy, Grace? And what advice would you share for aspiring leaders to nurture such environments?
Yeah, so I think environments where the leaders empower their people, I think that's a really important part of being happy. Because people who really want to do their best work, and actually sometimes it's when you don't even know what you're doing, but then you figure it out. Because I know that's what happened to me. And probably one company where I stretched and learned the most was when I got thrown into the deep end doing stuff I've never done before. And the CEO just trusted me. Like he never ever checked on me. He was always like, he just trusted me. And so I didn't realize at the time what a gift that was. And many years later, when I realized what a gift it was, because I worked for people who were the opposite, I went back to Kip and I would say, Kip, you are so awesome. You just trusted me. And he said, Grace, and he would say, you always willed things to happen. I guess it was because I didn't know what I was doing. So I had to just work, be really resourceful in knowing what questions to ask and going to people who could help me. And then that's how I had to will things to happen because I didn't know what I was doing. Yeah, yeah. But it was because he trusted me, put me in a position and area that I hadn't done before. I just figured it out. And he knew that I would figure it out because he wasn't going to let the investors of our company, the venture capitalists, like, you know, so he wanted a successful exit for us. And we did have one. Because then I brought in people and empowered them too.
Right.
So I don't know. Some of them, it was the first time they were doing it too, but I knew that they were resourceful people who really saw the vision. We all were in it together. Yeah. So I think having the same end goal and then having some positive friction, because I led the marketing group in that company, and Tom Hanlon, our head of sales, he and I had positive friction, and we still talk about it to this day, you know, over 20 years later. And so we talked it out, and I would tell my people, because they would say, oh, sales is not all these great leads we're giving them, you know, they're not following up on them. And I said, okay, let's go and sit in on the pipeline meetings. Let's go in. Each of you, I want you each to buddy with someone in the sales team. Understand what it's like to carry a bag. Understand the pressure they're under, and then help them. And so I think that initial friction that we had, we turned it around to make it positive to partner and buddy together. And it really helped us deliver the results that we needed to have our exit that we had.
I would imagine, Grace, that positive friction just leads to a higher level of trust. Higher level of happiness, less insecurity, and you're able to collaborate as a team.
Eventually
you went through an exit of some sort. So you're bonding 20 years later, as you talk about it.
We laugh about it. He said, you are so stubborn. And then he says, and you would say, what did you do? And then what did Dwight do with this? But then, you know, we would be at each other, but we were laughing by the end.
It's fantastic. Okay. So what common traps keep people from being happy and fulfilled in their careers?
Yeah. So I think fear.
Yeah.
I think fear from not using your voice because of fear of what might happen, then you may not try something that you want to try. Because the first theme of my Project Peak is you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
Yeah.
So, and oftentimes you don't take it because you're fearful. So I think having an environment where truly people are safe to make mistakes. I think failure, my number two thing I'm looking at here, is failure is a good thing. And so you can be in an environment where you're too scared because you think you're going to fail. And if you create an environment where people feel like that, well, failures are like, many failures are things that create success. Because you have to, like, I used to think every week, okay, what did I do well this week? And then once I figured out this positive psychology about failure, I have this thing called, I say, what did I fail at this week? And I actually worry when I don't have any failures, because you have to have failures to have success. So I actually now, instead of being like, oh, bummer, this happened, I think, yay, I can put up my failure column and celebrate my failure. And so it's a lot of leaders, they don't create that environment. But I think that those who do and create this more open environment, that's when you can truly have collaboration, where you can have success. But it's often leaders, some CEOs, they don't realize it, but they're scary to people who work for them. And they may not be scary to people maybe two levels below them, but they're really scary to people who work directly for them. And it's important to have that respect, but I think there's a certain art behind creating an environment where people are comfortable, yet respectful.
Absolutely, and it's the essence of innovation. Grace, I would add to that. I mean, if you feel free to play and experiment and fail,
yes,
how wonderful that is to nurture an innovative culture.
Yes. Just so you get, because perfection is not a good thing. Like, because you have to fail in order to succeed. Yep.
And so we're a society. Just on the question about the common traps that keep people from being happy and fulfilled in their careers, ambition. Overwork. I mean, these are just common themes, and we've all fallen into that trap, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Purpose, hope, and friendship. I mean, these are some of the themes which are real. The work-life balance as a predictor for success, and COVID has probably changed some of those dynamics now.
So I think these days I respect people who get their job done in the shortest amount of time the most. Brooks talks about crystallized intelligence, and it's in that back half of our life, which we're in now, right?
Yes.
And that's when, like in my coaching, it's not the amount of time you coach somebody. It's the questions you ask. It's asking the right questions. And that's crystallized intelligence. Just like Arthur talks about how being a professor that takes full advantage of crystallized intelligence, professors, as they get older, become better. I think with like coaching is the same thing. As a leader who coaches their people, it's the same thing. It's having that accumulated expertise and knowledge. Just this advantage of being older while you're is that you've been through all these different experiences. So you're able to bring the wisdom to the situation to direct, ask questions, which directs, like when I coach the coachee, into changing the way they're thinking or approaching a situation or seeing another side of it to make them have that aha.
Yeah. You know, I didn't read the book, and it's on my list, Strength to Strength from Arthur Brooks. One of your last posts or recent posts, Grace, really talked about it in depth between fluid and crystallized intelligence. And I want to talk a little bit about that. But I tell you what was really profound. My wife put me onto a podcast, actually, you know, where Oprah was actually interviewing Arthur Brooks. And a very similar story to your friend. You mentioned your friend who was very successful, did well. There was an example that Arthur was talking about of a lady who was probably a billionaire, really doing well, and then came to this, you know, top of the zenith of the hill and found that she was very unhappy, you know, didn't have a relationship with her spouse or her family, and, you know, really didn't know what was next. And he posed a question to her about, do you want to be happy or do you want to be special?
Yeah.
Do you want to be happy or do you want to be special? And after, you know, back and forth with her, her answer was, you know, in actual fact, I want to be special, not happy. Mm-hmm. How profound is that? And just think about, you mentioned some of the celebrities, you know, just think about how profound that is, that people actually, you know, will continue to make that choice. So it's not about happiness. It's about them being special.
Yeah. That is really deep. Yeah.
It's a fantastic, it made me stop and think for a while. It says, wow, you know, in all of our lives, how much of this is really about being happy versus being special? So I thought it was a very, very profound part of that podcast. I'm not sure if it's in his book, but that part was actually really, really interesting. You see it time and time again, you know?
Yeah, I think it is in that book. Yeah.
Okay, so back to positive psychology, you know, course 1504 became the most famed happiness course in Harvard history. In very quick fashion, Grace, what are the key takeaways from that course?
Yeah. So I actually written about that. So he talks about curiosity and asking questions are the traits that differentiate the successful from the most successful.
Yeah.
And I've also written about how the importance of asking the right questions. Yeah. I don't know if you read the post about when I was approached about being in a photo shoot with Annie Leibovitz.
And yes,
it was for a very, very large financial services for UBS. And they have had a campaign now that's gone on for now many years about asking life's questions. And so that's what made me really start thinking about asking questions and how important that is. And so I say in our consulting, we're paid to have the right answers. In our coaching, we're paid to ask the right questions. And so the number one thing I took away from Tao's course is curiosity and asking questions is really important. And then he also talks about learning. You have to learn to fail or you fail to learn. So that goes back to my thing about the failures. And then he says being perfect is not positive.
Yeah.
So a lot of people suffer from perfectionism and that keeps them from finishing something.
Yeah.
So I say perfectionism is not a good thing. I like to say that. And then he also talks about how behavioral change is necessary to follow cognitive change in order to have lasting change. So you have to do it after you intellectually know it for it to really happen, because action speaks louder than words, right? So one of my seven themes in Project Peak is having a bias for action. So that kind of it's correlated to that. And that's why I think it's so important. Like in some recent workshops I've been doing for companies, I do it along a 12-week theme, like for instance, my happiness course. And so I give the different things that I want them to practice between courses. So it's not just reading about it or talking about it, it's actually practicing it to make it happen, to have lasting results. You have to do it. Another thing Tao says is instead of trying to impress with an I-M-P-R-E-S-S, instead of trying to impress, express yourself and let people know you. Because so often, you may not even realize it, but people are trying to impress other people. And instead, be expressive. And part of that could be being vulnerable. It could be Tao's core. So the final thing that I took away from Tao's course is that positive psychology broadens idea generation, and that you sometimes need pain in order to bring in creativity. So he liked to say, never let a good crisis go to waste. So when you have a crisis, that can actually make you think more broadly. And you need both the good and the bad to be great. So those are some of my takeaways from Tao's course.
That is awesome. So Grace, on the first point about being curious, because I've actually written a post about that as well, and I'm an avid student on that. I try to ask a lot of questions myself. But you know, the great book, Mindset by Carol Dweck, talks about obviously a growth mindset compared to a fixed mindset. How do people in the camp of a fixed mindset suddenly become curious and ask questions? How do we nurture that in people?
Well, I think if people know the fact that happier people, it makes you happier, I think that could be a motivator. Sometimes it's hard because it's always hard to change, right? So I think maybe there's certain topics that these people might be more interested in, so they could start on topics that are of interest to them.
Yes.
Maybe that way. And then I think they might feel better and they might see some advantages of it. So it could go that way. I think some people, it might be mistaken that they're maybe a fixed mindset if they're introverted, for instance, because they're not just naturally asking questions. Because one time years and years ago, I was set up on this blind date, and the person I think was overwhelmed with all the questions I was asking him. And so instead of asking me for a second date, he asked me to do a brainstorming session, like a creative naming session for the second company he was starting. So I guess I should have taken that as a compliment, but now we're really, really dear friends. And so he says, I don't talk as much now, but anyway, but he's used to it. So he appreciates me differently now, but I think so. So sometimes I think that people may just, it may be a difference in personality type. So I truly think that if everyone realizes they can be happier by being more curious, I think some people are more natural learners than other people. Yeah. But I think if you go toward things that people enjoy, because that's what strength finders, that whole body of research is that to utilize your strengths. Don't worry as much about improving your weaknesses, but focus on your strengths. So focus on topics that are most interesting to you and explore those more deeply. And then find people who have common interest and deepen those relationships, because you don't have to be friends with everyone, because it's really the depth. It's actually, you know, having a smaller group of deeper friends will bring more happiness than having a lot of shallow friendships.
That's right. Okay. All right. So let's talk about your own journey, which has been very inspirational. How did your 3-decade journey from depression to gratitude to happiness change you, Grace?
Yeah. That was what the editor wrote on one of my posts. Yeah, that's what he came up with. So I think the one-year journey that I took 7 years ago, because I was afraid of falling into despondency because of my genetic predisposition, that was really big. I think, because my mother, I think as she got older, the onset of depression and anxiety was stronger. So, and I think that sometimes that happens to everyone as far as it, getting older, different life changes. And I think in this book, he talks a lot about that because people think your life is over like at 30. Like it was so sad when Miss USA committed suicide at 30.
Yeah.
And he has a phrase in here about a little three-liner from a physicist who thought his life was over at 30. So certainly just because some people are really focused on that fluid intelligence versus the crystallized intelligence, they think, oh yeah, here it is. A Nobel Prize physicist. It is better dead than living still when one's past his 30th year. So I think that we have to be more purposeful and more intentional about things that we do in this happiness journey that I did. So I think that was 7 years ago. And then when I had this severe depressive episode last year, that's when I decided, it was my 30th Harvard Business School reunion. Arthur Brooks was our virtual keynote speaker because he's a professor of happiness and leadership at Harvard. And I forced myself to log in for it. And when I heard him speak, it kind of reminded me of my year-long study with Tal Ben-Shahar. And I just thought, okay, that really helped me then. I must, like, when you're in the deep pit of being really depressed, you don't see a way out. You're in this dark hole and you lose hope. And I had a small group of a handful of friends who were hopeful for me. So I had people who were rooting for me when I couldn't root for myself. And these are friends that I really trusted. And they were there at the right moments, texting me or calling me just at the right moments, just checking in with me. And so that's why friendships are so important. When you're down in that deep hole by yourself. Years and years ago, when I went through a very unexpected separation, when I became suddenly single, and my happiness talks, I talk about being suddenly single with a 14-month-old. I had a family counselor and I also had a Stevens minister. And that woman was so helpful. I met with her every week. And it was so helpful that I then trained and was commissioned to be a Stevens minister. And at that time, I worked with people who were in that dark pit. And so when I got in that dark pit, 20 years later, I thought about, well, I've been on the other side before. So I knew intellectually where I was. And so I think I was doing all the things I think I knew I should do because intellectually I knew I had to do them. But emotionally, I thought, oh my goodness, you know, when you're in that dark pit, like you don't have hope. So it was really, really, really hard. So now that thankfully, and recklessly, like I was able to get back in my home that I missed so much. A lot of things, because I had relocation depression, I had compounded grief from losses, multiple losses in my life. I've gotten back in a really good place. I really would, that's why I've started writing and speaking. I'm going to add a new overlay to my happiness talks, including what I just went through last year. And I want to be as real as I can be so that if there's someone in my audience who's in that dark place, or know someone who's in that dark place and I can help that person, it's going to make all the difference to me. It'll make it all worthwhile. I think just like you say, your podcast, if you can reach somebody and make a difference, then that makes it all worth it.
And you're doing that, Grace. I'm absolutely sure. I read the responses and so on, and you're changing the world in your own way, Grace.
So thank you. That really makes me happy. That really, really brings me joy. Yeah, I feel very privileged in the work that I get to do. Yeah.
So in your journey, Grace, was it, I mean, when you kind of look back now, was it over time or was it, because you mentioned a couple of life-changing events, was it a result of the life-changing events, the two or so you mentioned, or do you think this was a gradual, you know, process? Because we all kind of are on the treadmill. We all, you know, we tend to focus on things in our life and some of this stuff gets put in the back burner. We're not necessarily all in that treadmill or self-aware or give ourselves time to introspect.
All right.
And go deep. So what happened in your personal journey?
Yeah, so I think a few things. One, I think being older and what we were discussing about that, things get harder. And I think that always before I had my son to be responsible for, because now he's on his own. And then my parents, they moved to be right near me for the last decade before they passed. I always had them to take care of, even though they were being cared for at their continuing care community and then the nursing home, I still was their one overseeing all their care. When they both passed, you actually need people to take care of, because as a single person with only one child and with both my parents passed, I didn't have someone that I was really responsible for. And so that was a loss. So the compounded grief was from losing my dad, then losing my mom, like in a short amount of time. And then I thought I always really studied and appreciated modern architecture. I thought for years and years, I wanted to move into a one floor, beautiful modernist home. And so I bought one very, very quickly, shortly after my mom passed. And that was too much. And then cleaning through this home, because I bought my old house back, the one I'm in right now that you see me in, going through in a very short amount of time to get this house ready to sell, 25 years of memories, because I raised my son in this home. That was a huge grieving process. And my parents had just died. And I was going through all the things they gave me and all my son's, all his memories. Cause I was able to keep a lot of stuff in this house cause it was just me. So I had what is called relocation depression. So it's the loss of my community here, my people and places here in Cary. So I learned so much, and and even though I never wish for anyone to be in that dark, dark hole, I actually told my life group a few weeks ago, I'm now thankful that I was in the dark hole, because now I'm happier and more grateful than I ever was. Things that I totally took for granted that I thought I'd never have again, but I miraculously was able to buy my house back. I now appreciate everything I took for granted before. So it's pretty amazing. Yeah. So I think that it was definitely some things that triggered the onset of my depression last year. And, you know, I've always said that everything happens for a reason. And when I was in that dark pit, I was thinking, I cannot find the reason for this, because I was like so depressed. I mean, I was suicidal. It was really bad. So, but I wouldn't be all thankful. So now everything's like, the glass is so half full now. So, it's hard to explain, but I'm just very, very thankful. Yeah, for so much now.
And that's such a significant theme, Grace, as you said throughout the past hour or so. It's gratitude and thankfulness. Isn't that just the wonderful? Isn't that one of the key things about being happy? Right.
Yes, it is, being grateful. Right, and that's why if I am asked to do a very, very short happiness talk, one very simple exercise that is sort of the most fundamental happiness exercises is to journal every day about three things you're grateful for. Yep. And then to write a gratitude letter and hand deliver it. So my former husband, who we have gone totally full circle on, he gave the most touching eulogy at my dad's memorial service. When I was going through all my parents' things, when I was moving out of his house, I found a gratitude letter that he hand wrote to my dad and hand delivered it to the nursing home.
Wow.
And I cried. Yeah. I took a picture of it and showed the family. And, but he was going through at the same time, because he and I both only had one son that we had half our time with. So he was going through the same course. Just by coincidence, we're both studying under Talvin Shahar. We met at Harvard Business School. And then, you know, many years later, when our only son is going to college, we're both doing our happiness journey. So he learned about the gratitude letter from Tal. So, and my dad loved him so much. My former husband loved my dad so much. I think it's pretty beautiful how a lot of things have come around.
That is awesome, Grace. That is awesome. Okay. So, let Grace and Richard try to fix the world, because here's the next question. You know, the cases of mental health issues have been on the rise globally. And we know that technology has had a major contribution to global mental health issues. Yeah. So Grace, how can society fix the epidemic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was on a in a small roundtable the other day with some presidents of some universities talking about this mental health issue, and they said that research definitely shows a correlation, the invention of the iPhone, with the rise in young people. So you're right on when you talk about technology. So I think doing some old-fashioned things and sitting around the dinner table with no cell phones, like no electronics, like just talking about things you're grateful for that day.
Yeah.
Doing old-fashioned physical things, exploring nature together without devices. And then like I'm reading this book about these students at Elon who did the adventure experiential learning and climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. You know, they're not with their devices. They're surviving and making it to the top through collaboration, from helping each other, from cheering each other on. So I think that the rise of bullying in young people, it's because of, bullying happens online. Yes. So if we can just have people doing things that we used to do when we were growing up, I mean, using technology, because I feel like technology can be used in a positive way, because I am so thankful for Facebook, because I could keep up with a lot of old friends through that. So you can use technology in a good way to help promote connectivity, but you know its limits, and then know the importance of actually being together. And of course, we know that COVID hurt that. But nothing can replace actual talking versus electronic, like chatting. That's really important to keep in touch between interactions. But I think Zoom is awesome to be able to see people, and then just doing old-fashioned things.
Great advice. Great advice, Grace. And I 100% agree with that. Okay. All right. Next round. What would you change in any area of life, not just business?
I would learn, I have slowly learned by, I'm a slow learner, I say, to have more fun. And so I want to be like my son when I grew up, because he knows how to have fun. So I think this being a dark place, and now I've come around where I think I'm having more fun now. I'm developing hobbies. I bought a grand piano. I'm practicing piano. I'm doing things I thought kind of like, well, why do that? That like doesn't build your business. That doesn't, you know, like tonight I have a Tai Chi lesson. I'm doing that in honor of my dad's memory. I'm learning the piano because my mom was my first piano teacher. So doing things that bring you joy are fun.
Absolutely. Okay, great answer. What are you grateful for in any area of life, not just business?
Yeah, I am so grateful that I have got out of that depression for last year. I am eternally grateful because I was in such a dark place, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak with you, for being able to share my story and to have a platform to help people in the talks I give and the writing I do and the coaching I do. Because one CEO said to me the other day, because I coach a lot of her leadership team, she says, oh, just go do that positive psychology stuff you do. Do that with, you know, my team members. So it's pretty cool.
Absolutely. Well, you're in service to others, Grace, and to steal Arthur Brooks's last part, which again I got from the podcast, it's, you know, his keys to happiness are faith, family, friends, and service, right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
He's just encapsulated in like four major themes.
Right. Being able to serve others is such a privilege.
Absolutely. Okay, the quick round. All right. In the last 10 years, what new belief or habit has most changed your life?
What beliefs or habits? I think, well, this whole positive psychology thing, I mean, that I just started studying it 7 years ago. So knowing there's a science behind happiness and that you have to practice it, because that's why I'm going back and I'm rewatching all 22 lectures. Because it's something that you just have to refresh yourself and continually learn, because you'll pick up new things.
Got it. Okay. What advice about the real world should a smart, driven college student ignore?
Okay. that grades are the most important thing.
That's a good one. I like that, because given your life journey and, you know, coming from China and being raised in that type of home, it's the same in the Indian type of home. So it's very, very similar there. That is great advice.
Failure's a good thing. Failure's a good thing.
It ain't all about grades.
In experiential learning. Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Good for you. That's a great answer. I love that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because believe me, I was obsessed with my grades. Yeah. In high school, at one point, I thought that I would die if I were going to be. Like, I was so obsessed. Yeah. And when I got my first B, like, it was actually a good thing. Yeah.
I love that. Okay. What can parents do to better nurture a happy environment at home?
I think doing those old-fashioned things, like taking the time to do those old-fashioned things, because sometimes they take more time and you can't multitask.
Absolutely.
Like really being focused, like back to what you're saying, the importance of being in the moment. Because when you use your electronics, oftentimes you're multitasking because you're talking to your kid, but you're looking at your phone. So I tell my son when I take him out to dinner, I say, oh, I'm taking you out to dinner, no phone.
That is funny. That's awesome. That's awesome. Okay. And by the way, you'd mentioned about the Kilimanjaro book there. I was thinking about a vacation with my wife and boys to Costa Rica about 5 years ago. And one of the things there, we didn't want to go to the tourist areas. We wanted to go in the rainforest, in one of the tents in the rainforest. And there was no internet service there. And for 2 or 3 nights, Grace, in the middle of the wilderness, in the middle of the rainforest, the synchronicity of sounds of nature, which were just consistent every day and night. You heard the same sounds come at the same time, which is just a beautiful thing. There was no internet service. And so what we had to do was listen to nature, play games, talk. It was so profound not to have cell phone or internet service for like 3 days.
Yeah.
It was absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, I love that. I love your sharing that. When I took my son, the first time we went to New York City, we ended up running in Central Park. It had just snowed and there was puddles of water everywhere. My son dropped his iPhone into a puddle. It stopped working. And he told me a couple of years later, he said, Mom, that was, because he was freaked out. He freaked out. He said, that was actually a good thing. Because he, for a few days, just experienced New York City. Like we experienced our time together. Because he did not have his phone. It did not work. He immediately like said, what can I do? He like put it into like rice and, you know, he's trying to do all this, but then he realized it's not going to work. It's going to be until we get back home that I'm going to be able to get a new phone, or, you know, figure this all out. But he reflected back and he actually said when he, you know, as a young person, he said it was a good thing.
Beautiful. Beautiful. How wonderful from a youngster as well.
You experienced it too.
Yes, and not.
So, you know, like, should we all drop our iPhones into a puddle of water, you know, figuratively, you know, we don't have to really, but, you know, giving ourselves time out, time in.
It's so true. All right. Tell us about the Project Peak, the climbing the mountains of life, business and beyond. So what were the quick key lessons that you learned?
Yeah. So that happened because I literally did meet somebody really fascinating who wanted to climb all the 7 summits with his son. So then I grew fascinated by researching it. And then I saw, and that was why my TED talk, I saw that there's all these correlations, because it's visioning, the group dream, agreement and alignment on goals, knowing what the goals is, like when you should turn back,
yeah,
having your passions, your supplies, having your investors, your sponsors, and having then figure out the right time to ascend. Like you have to be ready, right? And when you're going to launch, when you're going to exit.
Yes, absolutely.
There's so many correlations between doing the 7 summits and starting a company. So that's what motivated me in my TED talk. And then when I did the positive psychology work, I decided that climbing the mountains of life business, because before I did it for my TED talk, it was just about business, but I said, and beyond. Because I think there's such a correlation. Like, I think it's all fluid for me, like personal and professional and being happy, because they all intersect. So because of what we said earlier, it's happiness that creates success, not the other way around. And that's when you're happy at work, that's when you're a great leader. So I think that's why I said business and beyond. So my project peak and the seven themes I came up with, which are common sense, like you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, which I mentioned already. Failure is a good thing. Speaking the future now, because that's when you have to, when you're starting a company, you speak the future now. The power of visualization.
Yeah.
Channeling fear to your advantage, having a bias for action, and then enjoying your journey. Those are my seven themes. They're very common sense, but I like to go into them for with each person I work with, and because it's different for everyone. But it's good, important things. They're not difficult things to grasp, but a lot of times we don't do them. So it's just reminders. You have to keep continually remind yourself and continue to learn.
Absolutely. Well said. Okay. And the very last question, Grace, what is your one parting wisdom bite on being happy and well-being?
So I think it's what just remembering that happiness is what creates success is how it's so important to nurture all those happiness levers on gratitude, on friendships, in practicing those in your day-to-day life, taking care of your body physically, yeah, and eating well and doing all the things that you enjoy, that you're interested in. And then that's when you'll flourish and be happy.
Wonderful. Grace, and I want to end by again, another quote from Arthur Brooks, because he's just a fascinating professor. And his last thing was, use things, love people, worship the divine. How beautiful,
yes,
is it? What a way to encapsulate a happiness journey.
Yes, I agree. Yep. I think you'll really enjoy his book.
I can't wait to read it. But on that, Grace, thank you so much for this session. There were some just wonderful and very valuable wisdom bites. As I said earlier, you're an inspiration to me. All right. Your vulnerability, your authenticity, your service to humanity are just wonderful things. And Grace isn't just your name. Our 1 hour and 15 minutes or so together, I can see through your poise and grace, no pun intended, but that's how you live your life. So thank you for that very much, Grace.
Thank you so much. I'm very grateful for you and what you bring into the world. I really appreciate spending this time with you.
I love you very much, Grace, and thank you very much again, okay?
Love you too. Thank you, Richard.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I hope that you found today's session valuable. If so, please follow me on Instagram @outram.richard and post your comments. Thank you again. Until the next podcast.